evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, September 17, 2019. A rebel spokesman insists his group is not recruiting child soldiers.
In situations of war, the vulnerable are women and children, and often they are the ones who suffer. And so sometimes you might find that the civil population might seek protection from the SPLA-IO. But we don't have a policy as a movement to recruit child soldiers.
And thousands of families are displaced in Yei River State due to recent fighting.
We have left all our belongings to the village, including maize grains and non-food items, to the fighters. We are told that there is peace, but we have seen with our own eyes and concluded that there is no peace.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A spokesperson for South Sudan's rebel SPLM-IO, led by Riek Machar, says the group is not recruiting new child soldiers. Mabior Garang Dimabior says in a conflict situation, the most vulnerable often seek protection from rebel fighters. He was reacting to allegations by the chairperson of the UN Human Rights Commission in South Sudan, who says both government and rebel fighters have recently recruited child soldiers. Yasmin Soka, who visited South Sudan late last month, said some child soldiers were girls providing sex and labor services to both government and rebel fighters. Mabior could not confirm or deny those allegations.
I can speak from a political perspective and tell you that we don't have a policy as a movement to recruit child soldiers. But as we know, in situations of war, the vulnerable are women and children, and often they are the ones who suffer. And so sometimes you might find that the civil population might seek protection from the SPLA-IO. But we don't have a policy as a movement to recruit child soldiers.
You are protecting civilians who are running away from harm, but you are not recruiting any more child soldiers, or you cannot deny recruiting child soldiers?
Obviously, I'm not on the ground in the field, so I cannot confirm or deny, but what I can say is that as a movement, we don't have a policy to recruit child soldiers.
Your leader, Riek Machar, was in Juba last week. Are we closer to peace now?
Well, the peace is a technical issue, and our leader went to Juba in search of peace, but we have been put in such a position that the regime wants to present the SPLM, SPLA-IO as the obstacle to peace. So for the sake of finding peace and not making this be a stumbling block, our leader was courageous and went to Juba to discuss these outstanding issues, which are issues to do with the security arrangements, number of states, and other issues that are stumbling blocks in the peace process. These things are things which it's necessary for us to be able to follow the provisions of the agreement and bring about fundamental change in our country. If we are forced, like last time, to form a government with the idea that we will just standing issues after the government is formed, then we would be returning to the status quo until July 2015, when we were forced to form the government and war broke out while the first vice president and the vice president were discussing the reservation in the state house.
I don't know if I should say that I'm encouraged by what you're saying, but I hear you say many times that if we are forced, does the SPLA-IO feel that as November comes closer, you are being forced to reach a peace deal informing the government?
I don't feel that as a movement we are being forced. The agreement has to be a compromise. But the problem comes when there is no punitive measure from whoever does not implement the agreement. And so if we are being forced means that the provisions of the agreement are not being followed, and then we are told to still form a government, when there are certain provisions which should have happened, like, for example, you have to form the parliament first, the revitalized parliament has to be reconstituted, the constitution has to be amended before the government is formed. So if all these things are not done before, then it's a bad sign for the agreement. What I am saying has nothing to do with the provisions of the agreement being bad. But the problem is comes in when we don't follow the provisions of the agreement and we rely on the speech to come in some kind of supernatural way.
That was Mabior Garang Dimabior, spokesperson for the rebel SPLM-IO led by Riek Machar. He spoke with my colleague James Batty. We apologize for that poor telephone line from Nairobi. More than 15,000 civilians have been displaced from their homes in Logo Buma of Yei River State due to fighting between government and National Salvation Front rebels, according to several sources. Eyewitnesses say the fighting began 2 weeks ago. A church leader in the area says the displaced who are seeking shelter in the Episcopal Church of South Sudan compound in Yei need humanitarian assistance. Daniel Friday Martin has this report for VOA from Yei Town.
Charles Lugala Bashir, a community leader in Logo Village, is among the thousands of villagers who sought refuge in Yei Town. He says clashes between government forces and National Salvation Front rebels started on Sunday morning. Speaking in Arabic, Lugala says fierce fighting between the two sides is ongoing in Logo and Pisak villages west of Yei Town.
There was heavy shooting in Logo village. As a result of that, people were displaced into different directions without food and clothes. Logo village has over 15,000 residents, and many are still playing into Yei Town without food.
Lugala says at least 3 civilians were killed in the crossfire. Another displaced villager, Esther Yata, says the fighters looted her food. Speaking in Arabic, she says she left everything behind when she fled the fighting, and now her family is sleeping under mango trees with no blankets.
We have left all our belongings to the village, including maize grains and non-food items, to the fighters. We are told that there is peace, but we have seen with our own eyes and concluded that there is no peace, and if there is peace, why are they targeting us in this fighting?
Soba Samuel, spokesman for the National Salvation Front, says government soldiers attacked NAS forces in several villages around the Logo area.
This is a continuation of provoked military operations that happened there, not only in Logo area, but also in Lasso. Of course, it is going on. We have been saying we are committed to the cessation of facilities.
Major General Lu Rui Kwang, the government's military spokesman, says he has not been informed of any fighting between the South Sudan's People's Defense Forces and NAS rebels in Logo Village.
I'm not aware.
But Kwang says government forces clashed with NAS rebels over illegal gold mining sites around Lanya and Moka counties last week. Bishop Hilary Loatia Deborah of the Yei Diocese of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan says the church cannot provide humanitarian assistance to the vulnerable population.
The church doesn't have enough resources. So when people are displaced like this, what is immediately wanted is water and food. Now there is no food under the trees where these people are staying. Where am I going to get the food now? And this business of people coming to see and they don't act quickly is very painful. Where is the money that is put for emergencies? If there is no food in their stores, what about the money? I'm appealing for food immediately from the NGOs, from whoever is able to give us support, because we have run out of funds.
Obed Taban, deputy chairperson for the Yei River State Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, says his commission has no money either to take care of displaced.
These people are now 6 days here in Yei without food. We have food with the World Food Program stores in Yei River State, enough food. And we have been asking, requesting, actually this food to be given to these displaced people. And up to now, implementing agent of World Food Program has rejected it to give the IDPs the food. The food actually will get rotten and the people are starving. I don't know what does World Food Program mean by keeping food when people are starving.
Bishop Adeba condemned the ongoing fighting and calls on the warring parties to immediately put down their guns and resolve their differences peacefully.
In Yei, the war has not ended, and that is the truth. People deny this, but that is what we wanted to say. And these people who have not signed the agreement are fighting in Yei, just in the vicinity of Yei Town. And even when the government is formed, are we going to be peaceful?
8 workers on the ground assessing the needs of the displaced declined to comment, saying they are not authorized to speak to the media. Bishop Adeba called on the government to talk to the rebels so that peace is restored in Ye Town. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Ye Town.
Since its independence in 2011, South Sudan's print media has been struggling to survive. More than 30 newspapers and magazines have collapsed since South Sudan became a country. Several newspaper owners blame the country's economic crisis for their downfall. David Monodanga reports for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan had a vibrant print media when it separated from Sudan in 2011, with 34 newspapers and 6 magazines in publication. Today, the industry looks very different. Most newspapers trying to establish a foothold in the country do not last long enough to celebrate their first anniversary. Charles Rehan, the founder of the Juba Post, describes why his paper did not survive for more than 2 years.
We don't have print in Juba to print a newspaper. We print newspaper in Khartoum. And then when South Sudan separated from Khartoum, we went to print in Uganda. Because when you bring the newspaper from Uganda, newspaper will come late. That also affects Juba Post economical to grow.
Rehan says running newspapers is not like running any other business in that it requires professional journalists who ask questions, investigate wrongdoing, and force government officials to address the problems facing the country.
If there is something going wrong, journalists will say this is wrong, this is the right direction. But without newspaper, country cannot develop at all.
Alison Ismail, chief executive officer of the Star Tribune, says the hard economic times in South Sudan forced him to close his newspaper last year.
Nothing will put me to jeopardize or put myself at risk for doing business where I'm going to lose every day. Because this is a calculation. You calculate right, you succeed right. You calculate wrong, you fail.
Ismail says he will only reopen his paper after the economy picks up. A handful of newspapers have managed to stay alive. Anna Nimiriano, editor-in-chief of the Juba Monitor, says her paper is surviving these days, but just barely.
What is helping us is advertisement and the sales. So we are sustaining ourselves with it. If we follow the footsteps of others, there will not be even printing media in South Sudan. But I hope things will improve. For the media houses to come up is peace. Because if there's peace, everything will be stable.
Nimiriano says repeated threats, harassment, and intimidation of media practitioners by security operatives has forced journalists to leave their work and seek safety in neighboring countries. Irene Aya, the media development officer at the Association for Media Development in South Sudan, says veteran reporters and editors are abandoning journalism for better paying careers with non-governmental organizations or NGOs.
The salaries that they get is not motivating them to the standard that they have in terms of training. So many of them even have left the media sector and now they're working for NGOs as communication officers. And those who are working, there will be no doubt that also the poor pay is contributing to them accepting bribe in terms of transport, facilitation, in terms of lunch offers, which also can affect their objectivity.
Oliver Modi, head of the Union of Journalists in South Sudan, admits the union has failed to meet its mandate of fighting for press freedom, saying that mandate has been eclipsed by trying to safeguard journalists' safety. Modi says the union has created other protections for journalists, such as the collective bargaining agreement for media outlets and journalists.
If the employer denies you that right, the Union of Journalists of South Sudan will come in legally. We will use the legal procedure and then bring you on to answer why you are using this journalist without giving him the necessary rights that he deserves. For example, the journalist may need to go for leave. You don't give that leave. The journalist may need to have fair wages. You are not giving fair wages. You give fitnuts. That one will not meet the demands and the needs of the journalists.
A survey conducted by the Association for Media Development in South Sudan Amdis, found that the highest paid journalist in South Sudan's print media earn roughly 40,000 South Sudanese pounds, about $250 a month, while the lowest journalists earn about 10,000 South Sudanese pounds, or about $60 a month. Reporting for VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, an exclusive VOA interview with philanthropist Bill Gates on measuring progress of his foundation's work in Africa. We'll have that interview right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can we get more students interested in math and science?
To always have a practical approach to those things, to always relate it to the things around them in their environment, to make them understand that this is not something from the blue, it is around them.
A lot of them in practical work, because the subject is not more of a theory. It needs more practical so that it becomes more understanding, because it has more complex work.
Doing serious whatever, revision and practice, like practical work, then to motivate them actually. Those people who take those subjects, they do what? They earn, they've got chances of getting high quality jobs.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday Health segment. And today we have an exclusive interview with Microsoft founder Bill Gates about measuring progress of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Living conditions have improved greatly since 2000 for the world's poorest people, but billions remain mired in layers of inequality. That is the assessment from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation report on progress towards United Nations Sustainable Development Goals in Seattle. Gates spoke to viewers Leonard Modu about Africa's challenges in fighting climate change, improving education for girls, and making sure polio does not get foothold on the continent again.
To what extent is it possible to stop climate change, or is adaptation the way of the future?
Well, we certainly need to do both. I wish I could tell you that the mitigation effort, that is reducing the greenhouse gases, would be so successful that we wouldn't have to worry about adaptation. But even in the best case, we will have over 2 degrees of warming. And so whether it's droughts or big periods of heat, agriculture in Africa is going to be tougher in the future than it is today. The seed research system in the world is underfunded, and yet if we fund it properly, we'll come up with seeds that are more productive and can deal with the heat or the flood or need less watering.
Now, speaking of education, the report shows also that the gender gap in education is closing, but will persist in sub-Saharan Africa for the foreseeable future. So how can this be addressed to improve future outcome in education for young girls?
Yeah, so Asia, by and large, eliminated the gender gap in both primary and secondary school. Within Africa, there are countries that do better on the gender gap than others. But I'd also highlight that the quality of the learning experience is still something we can do a lot. There are kids who are in school for long periods of time, and yet their ability to read sentences or do simple math is not very good. And so helping to train the teachers, making sure we're picking the teachers in the right way.
You've been a strong advocate of vaccination and also fighting to ensure that children don't have polio. This year, Nigeria marked a milestone, which is reaching 3 years without polio. Can I have your reaction to that? How does this make you feel?
Well, there's a lot of credit to go around. Nigeria engaged. The heroes are the women who went out, went house to house, even up in the northwest, northeast, at some risk to their lives in doing that. So it's a wondrous effort. We're not done. We have to get to zero cases, and we still have some vaccine-derived cases in Africa, and we still have some wild-type cases in Pakistan and Afghanistan. But here's another milestone where it's been 3 years since any wild polio cases have been seen in Africa. We worry that, you know, it could spread back into Africa.
That's Microsoft founder and philanthropist Bill Gates. He spoke with VOA's Lino Mudu in Seattle. The International Committee of the Red Cross in South Sudan says violence is still pervasive 1 year after the signing of the revitalized peace deal. ICRC spokesperson in South Sudan says the number of patients with injuries from violence admitted to their surgical units has increased since the signing of the deal. Viola Elias has the story for VOA from Juba.
Florian Bastian Sirix, head of communications for the ICRC in South Sudan, says even though peace agreement was signed a year ago, the Red Cross surgical unit in Juba saw the number of gunshot victims rise by nearly a quarter over the past years.
From October 2017 to June 2018, 526 patients were admitted, mostly with gunshot wounds. The same period, a year later, we had 688, an increase of nearly 25%. In only 1 week in April, the ICRC evacuated by air 39 patients with weapon wounds to hospital with support.
Sirix points out that not all patients with gunshot injuries are the result of continued fighting between government and rebel forces. Some were hurt in armed robberies, intercommunal clashes, or cattle raids. Charity Sitima is being treated for a gunshot wound at the Giada Military Hospital in Juba. She says a man dressed in military fatigues shot her in the leg last month. Speaking in Arabic, Sitima says an intruder broke into her house about 2 a.m. demanding for money.
When I woke up to only see a gun and light, I realized someone has entered into our room, so he started to cock the gun at us. We were sleeping. He took some money and put it in his pocket. And he then told me to go with him. He started pushing me outside as I was crying to neighbors for help, but no one came. Then he shot me. He was wearing army uniform.
Elisa Baba says he was shot while returning from a market in Yei River State on a recent evening. Speaking in Arabic, he says an unidentified gunman began threatening him for no apparent reason while walking home.
I told him to leave me alone because I was going home. But he said I should go back to where I was coming from. When I refused, that's when he shot me 3 times, and the 4th one shot me on my leg.
Dr. Michael Mwandri, a surgeon at the ICRC surgical unit at the Juba Military Hospital, says it is unusual for ICRC team to carry out more than 10 different types of surgeries in a day. Oftentimes, he says, gunshot victims arrived at the unit days after they were shot.
Patients are scattered all over the country. This is a big country with not much infrastructure. So the transfer system will take time before a patient arrives to any hospital with a capacity to perform surgery. So my message will be, I think we keep on looking into ways how to facilitate faster transfers, and of course maybe also to bring the services closer to the people.
In addition, Dr. Mwandri says many ICRC facilities in South Sudan have been looted and several employees have been threatened since the peace deal was signed. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Zimbabwe, where the ruling party has recently revealed that it owns Robert Mugabe's family home, a move widely seen as pressuring family members who have been speaking out against the leadership and resisting the government's wishes for Mugabe's burial. And former First Lady Grace Mugabe faces a litany of political and legal challenges. The tension has become evident as the members of the family and the government argue over the fate of Mugabe's body. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Harare.
Weeping, she followed his casket, her footsteps heavy, her body draped in black lace. In public, Grace Mugabe has been the picture of the dignified, dutiful widow since her husband, former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe, died earlier this month at the age of 95. But behind the scenes, it's a different matter, as salacious details leak out while the government and Mugabe family negotiate with increasing bitterness about the fate of the leader's body. It has become a battle going well beyond Grace Mugabe and her family to reach the highest levels of Zimbabwe's complicated struggle for power. Derek Matyshak, a Harare-based governance consultant, says the fulcrum was in 2017, as speculation grew that the ailing leader wanted to install his much younger wife in his place. Amid this tension, Mugabe, allegedly under pressure from Grace, fired his deputy, Emmerson Mnangagwa. 3 weeks later, Mnangagwa used the military to pressure Mugabe to resign. Throughout, Matyshak says, it was critical for Mnangagwa to paint the power transition as a peaceful, voluntary one. Mugabe himself disputed that, calling it an outright coup, words that have hurt Mnangagwa's legitimacy. But now that Mugabe is dead, Matyshak says, the gloves are off between him and Grace Mugabe.
She's in a very weakened position from how she was before Mugabe's death. It was very expedient for Mnangagwa to continue to extol Mugabe as a liberation icon. So Mnangagwa has been at pains to say that all is well between him and Mugabe and to try and present that face to the world and to the regional leaders. The problem has always been, of course, Grace Mugabe, because many people believe that it was because of Grace Mugabe that Mnangagwa was fired from office by Robert Mugabe, but out of deference to Mugabe and because of that expediency, Grace was largely left alone.
That report by Anita Powell from South Africa brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Kitu Todi by Mede Musica.
Musa ya Ashan besado shabab tamoro, washan kaman bar fi den tana soba. Jorof ta tani mar shabab timoro ni fogo. Musa, is the abbreviation of Muri University Students Association. Has been led by several generations. Till now, Moses Musa. And it will remain Musa. Long live Musa. Patrick Enosa, Nesakman. Kutu. Don't go for the
We've been listening to Mede Musica with the song Kitu Todi. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks to our listeners in Tonch, Rumbek, Bor, Yei, Meridi, Juba, Yambio, Arua, Torit, and Magui. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.